Ulacumas was 2 weeks shy of his 14th birthday when he learned how powerful disappointment was as a weapon. Enlil looked at his son in the way that a man might look at a rotting piece of fruit to decide whether it was still edible. Beside him, Ningishzida looked impatient.
The procedure worked. You don't doubt me, do you?
I merely wish to see for myself.
Then I didn't need to be summoned here. I do have other business to attend, do you understand? Lord Marduk has asked for me to create a combination of human and fish to see whether proximity to the water might grant the apekin superior intellect. Relatively, of course.
Lord Marduk will wait. This is not another of your playful experiments on the local fauna. This is my son, Gen Engineer.
Yes, my lord.
Enlil leaned close, staring into his son's face. To Ulacumas, his father was just a blurred shape now, a shadow standing amid the burning fires that filled his vision. Ningishzida had assured him that the eyes would bond with his optic nerves in time, and that he would see far more clearly than he had ever thought possible. But for now, all he could do was comprehend the blurs, affixing the voices he could hear within the laboratory to each of the dark shapes.
My eyes are burning, Father.
Can he see?
This is a radical procedure. Your son's vision will take time to adjust.
Ulacumas watched the blurs move, wondering at what was going on right before his eyes as he lay on the bench in the center of the windowless lab.
How does it look, Father? Does it make you happy? What I've become. Father? Do I make you happy?
He was alone in the room. His father and the genetic contortionist had left. Kane rushed through the tall doorway that led into the pyramid-like structure at the center of the lifeless vill. He had known exactly what Baptiste was referring to when she had said she was in the administrative monolith. Even though the structure had superficial differences, its relative height and position made it clear to Kane that this was the place she had been referring to. Inside, he found the air oppressively hot, as if some heavy weight were pressing against him. It was also quite dark, the only light coming from the flames of a fire he could see located near the center of this single vast room that seemed to encompass the whole of the structure. As he ran, Kane flinched his wrist tendons, and suddenly the Sin Eater was in his right hand, powered there by the special holster he wore just above the cuff of his jacket sleeve. A few paces behind him, Domi and Grant were making their own way into the pyramid, holding back a little in case they were needed to provide backup. The thing in the center of the vast room was a furnace, Kane realized, and before it stood a group of perhaps 20 people. He scanned the figures, searching for Brigid Baptiste by her instantly recognizable, vividly colored hair. Instead, his eyes stopped when he saw the thin, brown-haired woman stepping toward the open door of the furnace, her arms stretched out at her sides, as if to welcome an old friend in a cheerful hug. It was Mariah Falk, the Cerberus team's geology expert. Two steps ahead of her, another woman, this one with gangly limbs that seemed so thin as to be just fleshless bones, took a pace forward and walked into the furnace fire. Kane watched, horrified, as the woman burst into flame, her thin silhouette catching light like a shadow held against the sun. The stench came to Kane's nostrils in a second, though he could never quite be sure if it was psychosomatic or if he could really smell the burning human flesh as the woman was reduced to ash and slivers of bone. And Mariah was next, unless he did something.
Mariah, no!
He ran toward the group around the furnace. Suddenly, everyone turned, more than a dozen heads spinning to face him as Kane sprinted toward them. He saw Brigid then, and beside her, the muscular form of Edwards, his face and clothes caked with mud. At the back of the group, standing beside the furnace door, a taller figure, a rough shape like something unformed, glared at Kane with eyes of molten lava.
Recruit!
Kane realized he was suddenly running headlong at a group of people who were rushing to meet him, with nothing good in mind. Mariah Falk watched as the emaciated woman stepped into the flames of the cremating oven and was reduced to nothing but bone fragments in the space of just a few seconds, her body disappearing in an almighty whoosh of cleansing fire. The Lord Ulacumas looked to her, instructing her to relieve herself of her burden to him. a useless recruit for his new model army. Better that she die now than drag the new world down with her repulsive presence. And the driving emotion inside Mariah's head told her she should conform. She stepped ahead, making her way toward the vaporizing fires of the oven. Domi ran with Grant into the gloomy interior of the pyramid, the silver Daktonics Combat Master 45 poised in her hand.
Is that Mariah?
Where? By the fire. I see her.
What is she doing?
Double around and stop her. Kane and I will deal with the locals.
Domi didn't need telling twice. She was already sprinting off around the approaching mob as Grant pulled loose his Copperhead close assault subgun from his coat and chased after Kane, blasting a warning shot into the sweltering air. Ahead, Kane found himself weaving out of the way as a half dozen fists made to hit him, and he felt two blows catch him on his left side.
Keep back.
The group ignored him, and Kane was reminded of the zombies he had faced out in the Louisiana swamps less than a week before. The big differences, he realized, were that Bridget and Edwards appeared to be part of this group, and every last one of them appeared to be alive.
Baptiste, what the hell is going on?
Kane stepped aside and kneed a mullet-topped farmer in the guts, making the man double over. Kane shoved him aside, letting him drop to the floor, clutching his bruised stomach. The next farmer was upon Kane immediately, swinging her fist at his head. The ex-mag had to give it to them. These crazies might only be farming types, but they were fighting with more than a simple sense of survival. Not professionals, maybe, but damn serious amateurs. As the raven-haired farming woman's fist cleaved through the air, Kane stepped back, then forward, so swift as to appear a blur before her eyes. As he did so, his empty hand snapped out and grabbed the woman by the wrist, using her own momentum against her to pull her off her feet. The woman flipped over herself, crashing hard against the floor of dirt and stone. Suddenly there was a booming noise behind him, and Kane turned to see Grant holding his subgun aloft, having blasted another warning shot up into the air.
Nobody move!
The zombie-like crowd ignored him. In fact, a number of them seemed to move as one to swarm at the huge ex-mag, knocking Kane aside to reach the newcomer. As Kane traded blows with the young, pretty boy farmer with whom Mariah had battled earlier, he saw Grant go down beneath a scrimmage of bodies. It was all getting far too dangerous, Kane told himself, and he drove his fist into the blonde-haired farmer's chest so hard that it knocked the lad off his feet. A fraction of a second later, Kane had raised the Sin Eater in his hand and spun to face his next opponent, his finger squeezing at the trigger. Before him, he saw to his horror the porcelain skin and emerald eyes of Bridget Baptiste as the first of the bullets blasted from the barrel of his gun. Domi was small and light on her feet. Where Kane and Grant found themselves immersed in the savage battle with the indoctrinated locals, she made her way past them in a series of whirls and jumps like some frenetic ballet performance. Two of the farmers stepped to block her path as she ran for Mariah, but Domi didn't slow her pace. As the first leaned in to grab her, Domi sprang into the air, running up the man's body in two quick steps. Her left foot slapped against his chest even as her right smashed into his face, knocking him backward. As the farmer fell, Domi continued running forward, her left leg racing through the air to find the floor once more. Two paces behind her, the farmer was recovering, lifting himself off the ground and turning to chase her, but she had gone, a white streak in the darkness of the crematorium. The second farmer, a well-built man with what appeared to be an infection on his lip, leaned forward, determined not to be caught the way his colleague had. To Domi, however, he was just another obstacle to bypass, and she dived ahead in a forward roll, sweeping across the ground below his reaching arms. As Domi leaped up from the rough floor, she turned back, her right arm whipping through the air, and blasted off three quick shots from her Combat Master revolver. The first slug drilled into the nearest farmer's left knee, bursting the kneecap apart in an explosion of blood and gristle. As the farmer stumbled to the ground, his legs whipping out under him, his colleague took the next two shots high in the leg and doubled over himself in agony as steel-jacketed bullets ripped through tendons. Despite the pain they clearly must be in, Domi noticed that neither farmer cried out. They simply flopped to the floor like beached fish, the fight going out of them. Still running, Domi turned back to her destination and saw Mariah Falk stepping willingly toward the furnace door, as though in some kind of trance. Beside her, a great stone pillar of a man watched, jagged, rocky structures arcing out from his shoulders like the horns of a stag. his eyes glowing as brightly as the fire itself. Domi was still 15 paces from the flaming oven, and she realized then that she wouldn't make it in time to stop her colleague from sacrificing herself. Mariah was stepping into the flames, and there was no time left. Domi's mind raced as she strived for another solution, a way to stop the woman from killing herself in those ferocious flames. Grant found himself swarmed by 8 of the farmers and was surprised to find how combat-ready they seemed. He crashed to the ground under the weight of the attack, batting at his attackers with the length of subgun that rested over his right arm like an armored sleeve. In a moment, Grant was lost from view, and all that could be seen was the dog pile that had overwhelmed him. At the bottom of that pile, Grant felt something slam against his face as someone tried to knee him in the eye. Another blow came to his side, then more as the angry farmers held him down. With a growl, Grant pushed upward, shoving the nearest people off him. 2 figures fell backward, tossed from Grant's body. Grant's left fist was a blur, jabbing at the next fighter, slamming the man in the face with such ferocity that his front teeth snapped in 2 and his head twisted savagely on his neck. Grant shifted his weight, gaining purchase against the floor beneath him as the remaining attackers continued to pile on him. He struck out, spreading his arms as he brought himself up off the floor. 4 of his attackers were thrown from his body, and just 1 remained, clinging to the huge ex-mag's back. Now standing, Grant reached behind him and wrenched the woman from his back, throwing her to the side like a rag doll. As Ulukumus watched the huge, bull-like man make short work of his developing army, the Anunnaki prince recalled another warrior he had known long ago, when he had first walked the earth.
Enkidu.
Grant powered forward, knocking aside the recovering farmers as they endeavored to regroup, batting each away with a mighty swing of his arms, blasting shots from his copperhead to ensure they kept their distance. Suddenly, Grant detected another figure come running at him at high speed, swooping low to the ground as the gunshots blasted into the air. It was Edwards, his old colleague from the Cerberus Redoubt.
Don't make me do this to you.
Edwards slammed into him, a powerful engine of taut muscle driving the X-Mag backward and forcing him to the floor. Grant's copperhead blaster went flying from his hand as he was slammed into the ground. Bridget leaped aside as the leading bullet from Kane's Sin Eater cut through the air toward her. Off target by just a fraction of an inch, the bullet streaked through Bridget's fire-red hair, clipping off a half dozen strands as it zipped past her and away. Kane was swinging his arm aside, shifting the aim of the Sin Eater, even as he relaxed his finger on the trigger, a burst of 9mm bullets uselessly peppering the ceiling far above them.
What the hell, Baptiste?
I can't stop myself. It's Enlil's son, Ulukumus. You have to stop him before he gets inside you.
Kane shoved her behind him as he continued running through the open area toward the furnace and the colossal rock creature who stood before it.
We'll see.
Another of the trance-like farmers stepped in front of Kane, blocking his path to the furnace. Kane didn't even slow. His fist lashed out, knocking the man off his feet as he continued to run toward the impressive creature of stone. Up ahead, he saw Domi failing to reach Mariah, too late to stop her from stepping into the fire. Domi would hate herself, perhaps, but she was out of options. Mariah Falk stepped forward before her, walking into the open doorway of the furnace. It was so hot that Domi could feel it here, 14 paces away from that opening. There was no time left for subtlety. Still running, Domi lifted the heavy Detonics Combat Master in her hand and unleashed a single shot, targeting Mariah's legs. It was a tough shot to make on the fly, and the oppressive heat and the general gloom of the room did nothing to help Domi's effort. Time seemed to stop as the 9mm slug left the chamber of the Detonics and hurtled across the room on its downward path. Mariah was stepping into the scorching heat of the oven, her brain frozen by Ulukumus's cruel command. Then the bullet struck, drilling into the back of Mariah's left calf and slicing the tendon that connected to her ankle. Poised on the threshold of the oven, Mariah stumbled and keeled over, sagging to one side as her left leg gave out beneath her. Ulukumus turned his attention back to his loyal devotee as she struck the ground beside him, and then he looked up in surprise as the albino girl came rushing at him, the combat master blazing in her hand. A fraction of a second later, bullets rained across his stone chest, striking sparks off the hard surface of his skin. Then Domi was upon him, leaping high in the air and blasting another burst of gunfire at the stone god's face. Ulakumas reached forward, his speed once again defying his apparent size, and knocked Domi out of the air like a man swatting an annoying insect. Domi was flipped back upon herself, and she sailed across the room before striking the floor beside where Mariah was sprawled in the pooling blood of her own leg. Immediately, Domi righted herself, balancing in a crouch like a cat, feeling the ferocious heat of the oven at her side as she assessed the stone monstrosity looming over her. Ulakumas turned his eyes on this curiously colored lesser being, admiring her weird bone-white flesh.
You will submit.
Never!
Domi loosed another blast from her handgun. For the first time since his return to Earth, Ulakumas knew surprise. The voice, coupled with the reinforcing power of the architecture around them, should make any apekin yearn to follow his command. Yet this one, with her white skin and ruby eyes, seemed utterly immune to its effects. Had the world changed so much in his absence? Grant crashed to the ground as his copperhead skittered away from his reach. Then Edwards was upon him, swinging his fists at Grant's face, kneeing the man in his groin. Edwards was strong, and his natural ability came through. Unlike the others, the farmers whom Grant and Kane had made short work of, Edwards was a trained military man and a physically tough one as well. But right now, it was clear that Edwards was following the commands of the enemy.
I don't want to fight you, man!
Edwards ignored him, driving a knee into Grant's side and rapping his knuckles across the ex-mag's jaw. Grant shunted Edwards away and pushed himself up off the ground. As he stood, Edwards came rushing at him again, trying for his double kick attack, low, then high. The low kick caught Grant at the knee, but the maneuver failed to pop his kneecap. Then Edwards' leg was sweeping higher, bashing Grant across the cheek and bloodying his nose. Edwards reared back, bouncing on his heels as he readied himself for Grant's countermove. As blood trickled through his gunslinger's mustache, Grant's lips peeled back, showing his gritted teeth.
Sometimes it's just gotta be so.
He rushed forward and drove his fist into Edwards' jaw. The blow connected with a loud crack, and Edwards hurtled backward, careening toward the ground. Grant stood ready as his Cerberus colleague crashed to the floor. The man slumped there, unmoving. Edwards was unconscious. Kane ran onward through the vast pyramid that housed the furnace, watching as Domi was slapped aside by the hulking form of Ulakumas. Like a wildcat, Domi leaped up again, blasting a stream of shots at the towering stone creature as he stalked toward her beside the open doorway to the oven. Kane saw that Domi's bullets were having no effect, and he commanded his own gun back into its wrist holster as he ran the last few steps to meet with the stone-clad giant. As he ran, Kane's hand plucked at one of the grenades he had lashed to his belt, automatically priming it with the swiftest movement of his thumb and finger.
Domi, get down!
Kane tossed the grenade at the stone god standing before her. Ulakumas turned at Kane's words and found himself struck in the chest by the hard metal shell of the grenade. Domi dived to one side, hands over her ears, using her own body to protect Mariah's supine form a few feet from the front of the furnace. Then the grenade detonated, the explosion blasting into Ulakumas's chest and knocking the stone-skinned Anunnaki backward. Ulakumas staggered, falling sideways as the blast shook him, and then he was toppling into the open doorway of the furnace like a felled statue. Kane was knocked back by the power of the explosion, and he found himself falling to the floor almost 10 feet from the front of the furnace. He looked up just in time to see Ulakumas struggle inside, a blackened smear across his uneven stone chest, the torches blasting jets of flame across his bizarre body. Lying beside the open doorway of the oven, Domi dragged herself up and pulled Mariah Falk across the floor until they were a few feet farther from the spitting fires as Ulakumas burned within. Then the chalk-skinned warrior reached for her own grenades and tossed two back into the opening, turning her head as they struck at the flaming form struggling to emerge from the stone archway. Kane blinked at the brightness of the explosions as the shockwave from the grenades slammed against the furnace and its lone inhabitant, crumbling one wall as they drove the mighty Anunnaki back into the center of those white-hot jets of fire. Then, with an almighty crash, the whole furnace began to crumble around its singular occupant, and a series of further explosions rippled across its surface as the unleashed flames burst from its breaking walls. Knocked down by the second volley of grenades, Ulukumus lay in the furnace, superheated flames jetting all about him, running along his skin like insects. Beneath his body, he could feel the broken fragments of bones and bodies from the farmers he had burned, the ones who had failed the trials by combat. Beyond the furnace's opening, he could hear the explosions rocking the pyramid at the center of his 10th city, the incredible ville he had built in imitation of his peers. The furnace itself shook as an explosion racked through it, and Ulukumus's body was showered with fragments as the pyramid's chimney began to collapse in on itself from above him. The jets of flame grew stronger as the chimney parted and a rush of oxygen was fed to the fire. Ulukumus remained, feeling those yellow-red tongues lick at his body. Ulukumus, who had forged weapons in the heart of a volcano, closed his magma eyes and thought of his father as the flames charred his rocky hide. Kane's head was reeling from the explosions when he felt a hand pulling at his arm, and he looked up to see Bridget Baptiste leaning over him.
Come on, hero. We've outstayed our welcome.
Kane pulled himself up, brushing at the debris that had splashed all over him with the destruction of the furnace. There was water on his face, he realized, and he peered upward to see the wide rent that had appeared in the roof of the pyramid through which the drumming rain was now falling.
Is everyone okay?
Let's just get you out of here before the whole place crashes down around our ears.
Behind him, close to the shattered entrance to the furnace, Kane saw Grant leaning down to help Domi lift Mariah from the floor. The geologist's left leg was dark with blood. All around the Cerberus teammates, the remaining farmers seemed to be standing about in a daze, unsure of what to do next.
What happened here, Baptiste?
Something about the ville makes people obey. I don't know how it does it, but Ulukumus somehow used it to make us go against our natural instincts. He was trying to create an army of warriors, I think, using the most brutal techniques in a sort of survival of the fittest contest.
Kane's leg was bleeding where a chunk of masonry from the shattered chimney had struck him, and when the adrenaline rush passed, he found himself feeling suddenly exhausted.
Obey, huh?
They were close to the doors now, and Kane spotted Edwards lying unconscious among the rocky debris of the crumbling pyramid. Taking a deep breath, Kane issued a command in the old magistrate voice he would once have used to intimidate lawbreakers.
Everyone is to follow me and my colleagues out of this building on the double. No stragglers, no questions. That's an order.
It took a few seconds, and Kane watched anxiously as the farmers seemed to sway in place indecisively. Then one, then two more, began to march toward where he stood beside Baptiste, close to the stone doorway that led from the pyramid to the outside courtyard. A few moments later, everyone began to march as though a military unit under Kane's command. Among the survivors, Grant came lumbering through with Mariah's form over one shoulder, the tiny figure of Domi padding along at his side. Grant leaned down to pull the unconscious form of Edwards up off the floor. Kane snapped his fingers, getting the attention of two of the ragged-looking farmers as they paced through the doorway and out into the cooling rain.
You and you, go back, help my friend with the unconscious man. Quickly!
To Kane's astonishment, the two farmers obeyed, turning on their heels and jogging back to help Grant with Edwards' body. Kane turned to Bridget, a sly grin appearing on his lips.
Well, this is all very interesting.
Don't get used to it. It won't last long now that Ulukumus has been destroyed. They're just receptive right now.
What about you?
Bridget placed her hand to his lips.
It only works on the weak-minded.
Whether that was entirely true, Bridget wouldn't like to say, but for the moment she felt sure that the alien box that had been inside her head had left, and her thoughts were all her own once more. Besides, it wouldn't do to give Kane too many ideas about bossing people around. Amid the wreckage of the crumbling pyramid, the remains of the oven finally crashed in on themselves. There were charred chunks of Ulukumus's stone shell mixed in among that wreckage, now just lifeless hunks of metamorphic rock, shaped and altered by pressure and heat. Domi set a series of charges along one of the rock walls, blasting a hole in it that the befuddled farmers could make their way through. They seemed to be waking up now, as though from some awful nightmare. As the farmers made their way out of the eerie stone ville, Kane's team set their remaining charges throughout the structures that made up the place. Bridget had insisted, unable to fully vocalize what she wanted to say, but somehow certain that the Vill itself held hidden power that they couldn't see.
Vill's mangle, people. Give them tangle brain.
Slash and burn seems the best way to proceed, just to be sure.
As they finally made their way from the eerie Vill, a gap appeared in the clouds, and the rain began to ease off to a thin drizzle. At the edge of the Vill, they found Mariah sitting with Edwards. The well-built former mag was looking confused, while Mariah tried to explain what had happened from the few fragments she could recall. She was showing Edwards her bloody leg when Kane, Grant, Domi, and Bridget joined them.
We're about out of here. How does everyone feel?
My head feels better, but my leg is burning like you would not believe.
I've taken a few bullets in my time, Mariah. When we get back home, we'll have Reba take a look at it. You should be fine.
I can't stand up.
You'll be fine.
Believe me, you may not remember it, but the alternative was a lot worse.
Still caked in mud and blood, Edwards pulled himself up off the damp ground and gave Mariah a hand up, letting her lean against his shoulder. He turned to Grant.
Speaking of, did we fight, you and me?
I wouldn't call that a fight, Edwards.
Edwards looked at Grant for a moment, wondering what he meant. All around, the dozen or so farmers were discussing their own travails, like abductees from some weird brainwashing experiment. Bridget took one last look at the strange Vill that had sprung up in the space of a week. The central pyramid had already collapsed in on itself, and one exterior wall smoldered where Domi had blasted a hole through it to create an exit.
It's strange. Kind of beautiful in its way.
The charges are primed, Baptiste. In 30 seconds, all it will be is a place to start over.
Destruction and renewal. The same things that Alakumas touted.
As explosions ripped through 10th City, the Cerberus warriors headed for the cavern where they had hidden the interfacers. Edwards had returned to Cerberus exhausted and had gone straight to his quarters the very second that his debriefing had concluded. While the others rushed to their new tasks, Kane and Grant in the Louisiana Bayou, Bridget working through the fundamentals of the Vills with Lakesh, Edwards had slept, crashed on his bed, still wearing his mud-caked clothes. It was midnight, cold and raining. Kane and Grant had used the Matrans to travel cross-country once more from the Cerberus Redoubt in the Montana Mountains, and they met with Ohio Blue in the murky core of the Louisiana swampland. As ever, Blue was dressed entirely in sapphire, a long dress tight to her legs with a single split going from the hem almost all the way up to her left thigh, a single ribbon choker around her swan-like neck. Her lips were painted a deeper shade of blue that looked almost purple in the dim exterior lighting of the rundown voodoo temple, and she pursed them as she saw the two Cerberus rebels approach in the airboat she had arranged for their arrival.
Well, you certainly do know how to keep a girl waiting.
Kane climbed out of the airboat and walked up the rotting wooden steps of the temple with Grant just a few paces behind him. As Kane moved, Blue saw that he had the ceremonial sword strapped across his back.
You'll have to work on your timekeeping, sweet prince, if you plan on impressing me.
We had little business elsewhere, coupled with the motherload of communications blackouts.
Ohio took a pace forward, leaning so close to Kane that her blonde hair brushed against the side of his face.
A true gentleman brings flowers, sweet prince, not excuses.
I'll remember that for the next time.
When Cerberus had checked through their logs, they learned that Ohio Blue's people had endeavored to make contact 2 days before, during the period when the communications satellite was still down. The message that had been left advised Cerberus to return to Papa Herban's temple as soon as possible, as there had been some developments. Although the message had not been left by Blue herself, it had specifically requested Kane be among the party sent. Kane couldn't quite fathom what was going on in Ohio's mind, but he accepted his role in their skewed relationship insofar as it gave Cerberus a valuable link to the underbelly of the outside world. Accompanied by the glamorous female trader, Kane and Grant made their way through the wooden-walled Javo room, where Kane and Blue had been fighting for their lives just a week before alongside Bridget Baptiste. Now the only people in the place were a handful of Ohio's men who were busy sifting through the trinkets and junk for items with possible resale value.
So, what have you found?
Something you won't like.
She pushed past her men and walked into the inner sanctum. Kane followed with Grant at his back. The room had changed from when they had left it. The walls were the same. The simple decoration of human bones on one wall and the hooks on the opposite wall where the sword had hung until Ohio Blue had snagged it for Kane. And the two pots remained at opposing corners, their dried contents looking as lifeless as Kane remembered. Grant gestured to the long leg bone that was mounted on the wall.
What is this? A kennel?
Where's the chair? The voodoo chair?
The chair's gone. It was gone when we came back here.
You didn't take it?
Oh, but that I had. However, there's more, Kane.
The beautiful blonde-haired trader led the way through the far doorway and into the other half of the temple. Like the inner sanctum, Kane saw that the whole place had been built with one side perfectly matching the other, with the same proportions to the rooms and a similar array of junk lining the walls. Here, as with the Javo area they had passed through to get to the inner sanctum, Blue's scavenger team were working through the trinkets on show, taking anything of value and tossing aside everything else. Kane hated dealing with filth scavengers like these.
What happened to the locals? We can't have dispatched more than 5 or 6 on our way out, surely.
8, at least. I prefer not to recall. Come.
With that, she motioned them into a side room that served as a bedchamber. The room was surprisingly ornate, with a large 4-poster bed in its center and silks of pretty colors draped across the ceiling, pinks and violets that fluttered a little as they caught a breeze. The corpulent figure of Papa Herban lay in the bed, his busy hands working at a bunch of rags, winding them around and around to form what appeared to be a child's doll.
Herban.
Papa Herban looked up from his busy work, and his eyes looked tired, their edges rimmed with red.
You back, boy? Didn't think you'd had the stones to come here again.
Kane reached behind him, unhooking the strap that held the ceremonial voodoo sword to his back.
I came to return this, just like I promised. Seems that things have changed some since I last visited.
Yeah, you can say that again. Surely you can.
What happened?
I thought that the gods had deserted me. She came back. Fuck. But she did come back.
She? You mean Azili Kornosho, whatever?
Azili Kornoir. Came for her chair, but found she had little time to kill. Play a little with her devotees.
What happened?
You believe in the path? You follow it?
Not me.
Your white friend tell you what happened the last time Mistress Izzy Cournoir visited. Mad bitch took my leg. And that of some others. Said it was a sign of devotion. Well, if it was as good enough for her once, why not twice, right?
He lifted back the covers of the bed to show where his body ended at the groin, both of his legs missing. The sheets were stained with blood, but the new wound seemed to have scarred over now.
Mad fucking bitch. Kill most everybody else. And those she missed, they run like hell. I'd not seen anyone till your woman here comes to raid the place. She is the one that patched me back together.
My people.
Figured.
Kane placed the voodoo sword on a walnut dresser that stood against one wall, a dust-caked mirror standing over it.
You really lucked out when you chose which gods to worship, huh?
People who don't believe in the path don't know the power.
Herban lifted the thing in his hands to show to Kane. Kane looked at the thing he had taken to be a child's doll, and he saw now that it was a representation of an individual, a female with lizard skin and penetrating eyes. While crude, the caricature was instantly recognizable.
Izili Kornoir come and mess me up. But now, I put a hex on her. When she come next time, I'll be the one who's in control.
His hand tightened around the doll's middle until she appeared to bend at the waist, bowing before him. Cain watched as the little fetch bowed in Herban's pudgy hands. Herban may say it was Ezili Kurnoir, but Cain knew better. It was Lilitu, dark goddess of the Anunnaki. She was alive, just as Brigid had guessed. Brigid and Lakesh sat together in a quiet corner of the Cerberus canteen, drinking coffee as they discussed what had happened out in Saskatchewan.
I would never have guessed.
I still struggle with the concept. The idea that the very design of the Vils can somehow be used to affect the human mind.
I don't even think it's really the mind. It's something more primal than that. Emotion, maybe. The shape, the tower at the center, it's like a magical symbol, a sigil that makes people conform. A very, very subtle form of control. The swastika used by the Nazis was a magical symbol, don't forget. Sigils have incredible power over the human psyche, far more than we frequently credit them. Somehow, Alakumus just upped the sigil's power, maybe because he controlled the rocks themselves. What is it?
What you've just described, the grouping of buildings with one higher building at their center, that is every city that ever existed. The financial district at the center with its towering skyscrapers, the lower buildings all around until it finally peters out into the rural areas of the surrounding countryside. If you were to ask any of the people at this facility, certainly those refugees from the Manitius moonbase who inhabited the 20th century, I suspect every last one of them grew up in or near a settlement as you've described it. Not always skyscrapers, sometimes a church, a cathedral. Go back through history and every settlement is the same.
The Anunnaki planned for a long time, Lakesh.
Brigid pushed herself up from the table, her empty cup in hand. Lakesh watched as the red-haired woman made her way to the serving area and helped herself to steaming coffee from a towering silver percolator there. Could Brigid possibly be right? Could it be that whole cities had somehow been constructed to affect people at some emotional level, to make them conform? Lakesh thought back to the Manhattan skyscrapers, Big Ben in the center of London, the pinnacle of the Eiffel Tower in Paris. Each city had the rudimentary design that she was talking about. Was it really a magical design that could somehow affect the way people thought? Lakesh couldn't say. Brigid returned, her coffee cup in one hand and a plate of cookies in the other.
They've just run out of whitener. Clem says he'll bring some over. Cookie?
Lakesh took one of the almond cookies and held it thoughtfully before him as he weighed Brigid's hypothesis.
Let us assume that there is some credence in your theory of the shape of Vils breeding conformity. Even setting aside the fact that you, I, and others like us broke through the spell or hypnosis or whatever it was, why, after the Nukos destroyed civilization, were only 9 new Vils built?
I don't know. That was all the Anunnaki we had, I guess. A city for each one. Just 9.
As she spoke, Clem Bryant came across to the table, carrying a little bowl of coffee whitener, and he set it down beside Brigid.
Just 9 what?
Baronies. 9 Anunnaki hiding in 9 Vils.
Because 9 is the number of the universe.
Brigid and Lakesh turned to him, equally stunned and bemused by his left-field statement. Clem smiled enigmatically.
In Hindu belief, Ganesh, the source of creation, is 5, and the Shakti of destruction is 4. Thus, 9 is the sum of these two facets, creation and destruction, the number of the universe. 9 is energy, and energy can never be destroyed.
Where do you get this stuff from, Clem?
Do you think it's significant?
It might just be.
In that moment, it seemed to Brigid and Lakesh that the world of Vils and resurrected gods that the Cerberus warriors inhabited had become just a little bit more convoluted and a little bit more dangerous than they had previously realized. Edwards awoke to the gnawing feeling of his empty stomach. He was ravenous. It felt as if he hadn't eaten in a month. He pushed himself up off the mattress and reached for the lamp, a durable angle-poise type that arced over his bed. The bulb popped to life, and Edwards narrowed his eyes for a moment against the glare in the otherwise dark room. He was still dressed, he realized. Worse, his clothes were covered in dried mud, and as he moved, he saw that a whole layer of the stuff had flaked off all over his bed.
damn it!
Edwards brushed at the mud only to realize he was making it worse. He would get food, then come back and clean up here, strip the bed and sweep the floor of any mud that shook out of it. Even as he thought it, he realized he'd need to get changed before he went to the on-site canteen facility and at least make some effort to wash up. Irritated, Edwards made his way across the room to the tiny cubicle that served as an ensuite bathroom, though was really just a basin with a shaving mirror alongside the toilet. As he stalked across the room, Edwards stripped off his undershirt and tossed it on the floor, and dried mud cracked from the folds and skittered across the floor tiles as it landed. Screw it, he was going to sweep the room anyhow. Then he saw himself in the mirror and realized he hadn't been kidding about needing to wash. His face was smeared with dried mud and dried blood, and when he reached for the faucet, he saw more mud ingrained into his fingernails. He remembered punching some guy in the throat as they lay together on the ground, and he laughed in spite of himself. It seemed faintly unreal, like recalling a dream.
Crazy shit.
A moment later, Edwards was splashing water in his face, eyes closed as he used his hands to wipe the dried muck away. When he opened his eyes, Edwards saw that there was still a little dirt by his ear and a smudge on his forehead. With another splash of water, Edwards brushed at the dirt. The smudge on his head wouldn't wipe off.
What the?
He rubbed harder at his forehead. It felt as if there was something there, a hard lump like a callus. He pushed against it and felt the rock-hard lump disappear, sinking back into his skin.
Weird.
Edwards grabbed up a new shirt from the single chair in his one-room quarters and made his way out to get himself something to eat. Epilogue. It was afternoon in the Middle East. The sun pounded down from a clear blue sky as a lone figure strode purposefully across the fertile lands along the banks of the timeless Euphrates River. Wrapped in a cloak of heavy fabric that was colored as red as blood, Enlil watched the bright sunlight reflecting from the river's glistening surface. It was hot out here, away from the shadows that he had become accustomed to during his enforced exile after the destruction of Tiamat. And he wore the cloak as much to keep the sun off his scales as he did to disguise his unusual appearance from the local apekin. It had been one Earth week since he had planted the Tiamat seed, one week since he had left the tiny seed within the fertile soil on the banks of this river where the first Anunnaki outpost had stood thousands of years before. Far away, a noise caught Enlil's ears, carrying as it did on the wind, and he glanced up, the vertical slits of his pupils narrowing as he peered at the distant horizon. A nomadic trader was making his way across the sand there, two camels following in his wake, each of them weighed down with the trader's wares. Enlil watched for a moment longer, saw the trader turn and begin to approach across the empty plain. Lord Enlil turned away, his eyes roving along the ground as he sought evidence that the Tiamat seed might be germinating. The wind blew the dry topsoil back and forth, churning its particles up in tiny whirls that skirted along just a few inches above the ground before sinking back. There, close to Enlil's left foot, a tiny sliver of green poked from the soil. It had been but 1 week, and yet the stubborn spaceship womb was reforming, recreating herself from just a handful of cells, as she had recreated Enlil and his siblings just a few years before. Tiamat was being reborn from the tiny sliver that he had planted here at First Outpost. Once the mothership was large enough, once she was strong enough, Enlil would access her knowledge banks, immerse himself in the data flow, and then he would pluck the things he needed so that he might finally rule this tiny kingdom called Earth. Enlil looked up from the single tiny chute as the nomadic trader neared, peering at the man from beneath the hood of his blood-red cloak.
Good day to you, fine sir. Might I interest you in something? A new cloak, perhaps? Or a blanket to keep yourself warm when night falls?
His face hidden by the shadow cast by his hood, Enlil smiled.
There is but one thing I require.
The trader gestured to the many things that hung from the backs of his camels. There were copper pots, drinking bottles made of soft leather, Thick blankets and thin silks of many colors, stoles, lucky charms, and even curiously, a woman's parasol, its color long bleached away by the fierce sunlight.
Name it, fine sir, and it shall be yours.
The future. And you are correct, Apekin. It shall be mine.
Outlanders 54, Oblivion Stone by James Axler is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright and production copyright 2022, Graphic Audio LLC, all rights reserved. Unauthorized download and or duplication is prohibited. Narrated by Terrence Aselford, with performances by Nanette Savard as Bridget, Terrence Aselford as Kane, Zeke Alton as Grant, Shravan Amin as Lakesh, Mort Shelby as Edwards, Scott McCormick as Ulikumis, and Nora Ashrati as Mariah. With Bradley Foster Smith, Michael John Casey, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Ken Jackson, Brandon Burton, Laura C. Harris, Jessica Lauren Ball, Todd Schofield, Dawn Ursula, Richard Rowan, Dylan Lynch, Stefan Walker, Yasmin Toison, David Zitney, Chris Davenport, and Matthew Pauly. Adapted for Graphic Audio and directed by Steve Wanall. Dialogue editing and Graphic Audio sound design by Michael Hanusiak. Produced by Rick Rowan, Dwayne Beeman, and Matt Webb. Executive producer, Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to listen to Deathlands by James Axler or The Templar Chronicles by Joseph Nassis, along with our whole catalog of Action Pump titles, including the Graphic Audio Story Podcast, or GASP, available at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for a preview of another exciting title in Graphic Audio.
When 19-year-old Huntress Feyre kills a wolf in the woods, the consequences drag her to a treacherous magical land she only knows about from legends.
Let me make this clear for you, girl. You can either come live at my home in Prithian, offer your life for the wolves in that way, or you can walk outside right now and be shredded to ribbons. Your choice.
A friend of my cousin went to the border as our offering to Prithian, and she has not been sent back. Now she dwells in riches and comfort as a High Fae's bride. And so might you, if you were to take a moment
She was likely eaten. That's why she hasn't returned.
Feyre's understanding of the world is turned on its head as she learns more about her host and his lands.
Were you trained as a warrior then?
Yes. I spent most of my life in my father's warband on the borders, training as a warrior to one day serve him, or others. Running these lands was not supposed to fall to me.
Tamlin gets into moods. He would probably shred them for disobeying his order to stay away.
He would be that brutal?
You don't hold on to power by being everyone's friend. And among the fairies, lesser and high fae alike, a firm hand is needed. We're too powerful and too bored with immortality to be checked by anything else.
That's what happens when you're responsible for lives other than your own, isn't it? You do what you have to do.
You want what I expected for a human.
But an ancient, wicked shadow over the fairylands is growing, and Feyre must find a way to stop it, or doom Tamlin and his world forever.
And what can be done about this blight that has spread in Prithian, stealing and altering the magic? Where did it come from?
Stay with the High Lord, human. That's all you can do.
I don't know. I don't know what's happening.
Feyre!
Available now in Graphic Audio.
Thanks for listening to this Graphic Audio production. Graphic Audio has over 1,500 titles to choose from. Listen to over 150 binge-worthy series, from sci-fi to fantasy, to graphic novels, to mystery thrillers, to action-adventure, to westerns, and more. Check out our exclusive titles, available only in our dramatized adaptation format. If you'd like to listen to an entire series, you can conveniently purchase a download series set at graphicaudio.net. You can also earn loyalty reward points, redeemable towards future online purchases. Stream audiobooks immediately or download them to listen offline on your mobile phone or tablet using our Graphic Audio Access app, which is available on all Android and Apple devices. We like being radically different when it comes to our audiobook productions. Listen to A Movie in Your Mind, on the go, anytime, anywhere. Sign up for our email newsletter for the latest updates and new releases. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Visit our web store today at graphicaudio.net.